tonight on Arena. Guy Barker on the music of the 1950s and how it changed the world, and Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, like Chimera, and Made in England, Paula Pressburger, are the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us live on the live stream. rte.ie/arena is where you will find that. And tonight, film reviews, Apes, Antiques and Cinematic Legacies. In the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, the nostalgic action franchise gets rebooted once again, with primates and humans battling as usual for supremacy. And it's a move from steamy tennis to Italian grave robbing for hot young actor of the moment, Josh O'Connor. That's in La Chimera. And it's an Italian movie, obviously. And Martin Scorsese digs deep into his fascination with two of the most influential filmmakers of the 20th century in the documentary Made in England, and the Pals of Powell and Pressburger. John McGuire, Caro Doherty have been to the cinema for us, and they join me in studio this evening. Let's start with the Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, which comes to us 6 years after the last reboot trilogy ended. Charlton Heston has a lot to answer for.
Yeah, Charlton,
well, it's not
Heston
him particularly.
On, yeah,
yeah. I mean, this. When do we let go of the Planet of the Apes?
This is the thing. Pierre Boulle wrote this book in 1963. They made the Planet of the Apes out of it, which was a huge film at the time. With one of the greatest endings of all time. And a, you know, cutting-edge technology
When I hear Planet of the Apes, that's what
that's what I think of.
The Statue of Liberty. Sticking up in the sand and, and Charlton Heston.
So they made a lot of those films. I mean, they made five or six of them, I think. Then Matt Reeves made a trilogy of a reboot, which ended 6 years ago, like you said.
Of course, there was the television series.
And a cartoon as well.
Yeah,
a cartoon
as well.
And now we have another reboot, a continuation, many generations later, the legend tells us. We've got, in the far future, intelligent primates, artificially evolved by a man-made virus, become the apex species while humanity has declined into this feral primitive state. The great chimpanzee leader Caesar, who was the hero of the last three films, he's gone. The liberator of the species. Ape civilizations have emerged from the society that he established and spread around the continent, the American continent, which is, there's ruins of former human civilization all over the place. So there's this king, a bonobo, a king, Proximus, played by Kevin Durant. He starts a campaign of enslaving and subjugating the apes against Caesar's traditional teachings of ape together strong. And when his clan is attacked, this character, Noah, who's our new hero, played by Owen Teague, when his clan is attacked and the people are abducted and enslaved, he sets out to find them and bring them home. That's the quest.
Yeah, it's to a certain extent, Carrie, it sounds like this is more about an inter-ape war than it is about a kind of an interaction between the apes and the humans.
It is. The humans have taken a big back seat in this. Literally, most of them have regressed. They're outcome prehistoric. And in theory, it is an interesting idea, because apes, for a time under the great Caesar, they were united, as John said. They were together, they were strong. And it's quite interesting that apes have followed the typical change in civilizations. Now that Caesar's gone, you know, have the big bully guy, everyone's divided. And in theory, that's actually a really good idea. It's kind of interesting to think that apes are following the path that we set.
History repeats itself, exactly, whether it's ape or man.
Absolutely. Yeah. But at this point in time, do we need more apes?
Well, although I have to say, Proximus Caesar certainly has charisma, if not just downright dictatorship. Let's hear Kevin Durant in the role and his loyal followers shouting back.
What a wonderful day! Are we thankful for the words of Caesar?
We are thankful.
Do we bend our heads?
We bend.
Say his words. Say his words. What a wonderful day!
Night. take back what I said. Kevin Durand there as Proxima Caesar,
very Trumpian.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously they're kind of are they drawing that type of contemporary
Absolutely.
Parallel
there
here?
There is no
John?
Doubt about it. Yeah, there is a definite element to the guy, to this character's charisma, his corruption, and his venality, and all the rest of it. That's pretty thinly drawn, but. Along the way, Noah, this character, he meets May, who's played by Freya Allen.
You're
people might know
to a woman
from The Witcher.
Stormy, but no,
no, not
May.
A woman called okay. Stormy. Her name is May. They call her Nova, as another callback to the original film. And an orangutan, an educated orangutan who can read, played by Peter McCann. And the three of them come together to make this journey to the citadel that Proximus has established across this unmapped land that holds secrets about the past and these hints of a potential future, because this is the first in a proposed new trilogy of films. So it takes a while to get going.
Yeah.
You're introducing a lot of new characters. There's a new timeline. There's a new history. Yeah. There's a lot to establish. And I think the first half of the film is a lot more effective than the second half of the film. It's when it's slow and careful and you get an idea of the world that they're trying to create.
Yeah.
But when it falls back into regular action movie, it hits all of those beats. Things happen. There's a little MacGuffin they have to chase. They're looking around for things. It starts to become a little bit samey and formulaic. And when you're talking about something that we've seen over and over and over again, samey and formulaic, doesn't work anymore.
The they that we're talking about here in terms of recreating this new world, Wes Ball is involved here again, yeah.
And he came from the Maze Runner films, which are quite dark. And this is darker.
Yeah.
There is sort of touch of the slavery in those elements. It is kind of a dark side of the ape land. But one of the things that really, the apes are now part of different clans. And this Noah comes from an eagle clan. And I think there must be about 15 minutes of an introduction about why his clan need eggs to raise eagles. And honestly, I'm still sitting here going, what was that about? What was the... And there's... I mean, it's just bizarre, this hunt for eggs. And, oh, look, we're apes raising eagles. It's all a bit strange.
Yeah. And briefly, Cara, how does it look? Is there a lot of CGI here?
The thing is, it does look fabulous. Oh. I will give it that 100%. It looks incredible. John referred to the kind of ruins of humanity. And they look kind of fast. It looks fantastic. You see what we do to the world and how what even... thousands of years later, the wrecks of humanity are still lying around the place. But the apes themselves, they look amazing. And to sound like a child, I'm finding it hard to believe that they weren't actually real. I was like, how did they get the monkeys to talk? They are incredibly expressionistic. So from that point of view, it does look fabulous.
Yeah, but the more photorealistic it looks to me, the faker it feels when you're sitting there watching it. Monkeys don't talk. So why, you know... But you can see individual hairs on the monkey's head. You know, I mean, it is so precise and so beautifully drawn.
It's too real.
That it's too real. It feels kind of hyper real.
It's a great sound. The talking monkeys are too real.
Too real, yeah.
Stars from you on this one, Cara.
I'm going to give it 3 for how it looks. And also, the performances are very strong. It just, there's far too much meandering. And it's about 2.5 hours long. They could easily lose an hour off that. There's a good film in there somewhere, but they'd have to dig it back out.
And overall, stars from you,
3 stars from me, Sean. A passable effort, nothing to go bananas about.
Oh, you couldn't let it go, could you? All right, let us move on then to La Chimera. This is after the success of Challengers, which is the big tennis film. It's easy to see why a smaller Josh O'Connor film would be getting a release right now. La Chimera is, as I say, the title of this piece. He plays a character called Arthur, brooding archaeologist / grave robber who grapples with lost love and lost meaning in this beautiful Tuscan set film. The director here, probably when we say Alice Rohracker, we know what we're going to get, or maybe we don't know what we're going to get is the point here, Cara.
I think that's it. More, we're not quite sure. She's a very singular director. Her style is very unusual. She, and particularly with this, she plays with the aspect ratio. She plays with the speed of it. She speeds things up and slows it down. It's all very unexpected. But Arthur, Josh O'Connor's character, is interestingly, somebody who loves his artifacts and his archaeology, yet he has become a grave robber. So he's very conflicted by this. I'm also very conflicted as a semi-retired archaeologist that I had to watch a film about grave robbing. I'm still not over this. It's very disturbing. At the same time, it's quite nice to see Josh O'Connor being so mournful. We see him in Challengers recently, and it's this complete opposite side of the coin.
Yeah, there's a lovely internalized nature to it. I didn't get to see all of it, John, but there's a lovely internalized nature to his ease in front of the camera.
Yeah, he's a very, very good actor. And we were introduced to him on a train and he's kind of slumped over. We've discovered that he's just out of prison. He's wearing this tatty white linen suit. He looks sick. He's got the jail fever.
Smoking too much as well.
He smokes a lot. He doesn't eat. Yeah. You know, he's on his uppers. He's been involved with this gang of desecrators who are desecrating these ancient Etruscan tombs for artifacts to sell, who are led by a character called Spartaco, who's a mystery in the film. And he's taken the train back to this little hand-built shack that he lives in just outside the walls of a town in Tuscany. And he reconnects with his benefactress, who's played by Isabella Rossellini, beautifully played by Isabella Rossellini, who's the mother, so-called mother.
She's a phenomenal character.
Yeah, she's brilliant. Of all those women, really, she's got a lot of daughters.
Whole family around her.
Whole family. We don't know if they're daughters or granddaughters.
Could be anything
what they
to
are.
Her, yeah.
But one of them, Beninina, who's played by Yili Yara Vianello, Josh O'Connor's Arthur was in love with her. And he starts to plan this one big heist that's going to, the big dig that'll finally make him and his little gang of friends rich. And all of that sounds perfectly normal, Sean. It sounds like the plot of a movie, but Alice Rohwalker doesn't do that.
Yeah.
And it could go anywhere and it goes everywhere.
And there's a character called Italia. We kind of need to have a rough idea who she is because she's vital to the plot. And does she, or did I imagine this, turn directly and speak to the camera a couple of times? Certainly does it once in the opening section.
There is, and there's another character who also
does the same thing.
But yeah, so Flora, Isabella Rossellini's character, she is this grand dame of this crumbling pile of a villa. And she used to be a singer. So she teaches singing lessons to Italia, played by Carol Durata. Italia, she lives there. She doesn't pay for the singing lessons. She pays for her singing lessons in basically being a maid, but she has a secret. Her kids are also living in the house with her, hidden away from Flora. And Arthur, he twigs this, and despite the fact that he is heartbroken and wishing for his Beninina to come back, he starts this lovely flirtation with Italia, but it's all done through Italian hand gestures, which is quite bizarre and very lovely to watch as they flirt across a room with these little, very Italian.
The Alba Rohwalker, who plays the, who's a kind of a shady dealer in antiquities. Is she related to the aforementioned
Alice?
Her sister.
Yeah, that's her sister.
She is her sister, right. Her sister. Well, here she is then. She gave job to the sister to be this shady dealer in antiquities. And this is one for you. Again, your inner archaeologist, I think, will be upset by this scene as well, Cara.
The piece is part of an inheritance that dates from before 1937. But it has remained in the shade for all these years. What can I say? Die Rückseite, bitte. How many people would pay to see it? Thousands? Millions? Billions? The tire. Here, we are looking at the new Venus of Milo, the new Nike of Samothrake. It's her, the goddess of animals. We introduce you to the Cybele of Etruria.
There you go. So most of this film, it has to be said, is in Italian, obviously, but there's a little section in English with Alba Rohwalker, a sister of the director, trying to pawn off these shitty antiquities. You're still upset by all
I'm
of this,
still
Cara.
Upset. I'm not getting over it. There's a moment where only the geeky people out here will understand, but they reference a Calyx and say how it's not important. And honestly, at that point, if people out there who speak my language, Calyxes, we all know they're important.
Well,
that's all I'm saying.
I will bow to your superior knowledge on that one. I'm presuming you will too, John, because you're very quiet.
I'm very quiet over here.
Yeah, I think I'll move on from it. I suppose you can't get involved in a plot really here because, as you say, John, it goes all over the place.
Yeah.
But are we left with there's some amazing images in this. There's one section, he's a kind of a diviner. He does this thing.
He goes
where,
into a trance, yeah.
Rather than finding dowser, water with his divining rod, he finds graves. Mm. But the whole camera, the whole thing, the ground turns upside down. I don't even know how she did this. But it's extraordinary to look at.
What we're looking for is invention and reaction. And I know Cara was upset by the way that they're treated, but that's the point of the film, is that what do we do with culture? What do we do with the things that are in the ground? How do we respect them? What's the best thing for them? Should they be dug up and put in a museum? That's one of the questions. But she's also asking those kind of questions about film and about how we make films and how we create narratives and what we do with fast forwards and speed ups and change in aspect ratios and messing with the camera and speaking to directly characters, breaking the fourth wall. She's playing with all of that as well, and she's asking those kind of questions. So it's full of contradictions. It's frequently ramshackle, now I have to say, and it's deeply odd, but it is her work. And if you've seen her other films, you pick up on that vibration that she's trying to create very quickly. But somehow, against all logic and sense, I thought this was utterly charming. And O'Connor is a movie star. He's a proper movie star. So
stars from you on this one, John.
Oh, four. I really enjoyed it.
Good, solid really four. Cara? Yeah.
Despite the heartache, four as well. I thought it was this excellent mix of myth and realism. And it's a special film. Definitely worth a watch.
Mm. Okay. La Chimera, the title of that Italian. It was a Palme d'Or winner, wasn't it, in recent times?
Screenplay, I think. Yeah, she won for screenplay.
All right. Let us move on then to our final film. Legendary director Martin Scorsese presents Made in England, a feature documentary directed by David Hinton about the filmmaking duo Powell and Pressburger. Just listening to Martin Scorsese talk about the way he can talk about film is quite extraordinary. But clearly, Powell and Pressburger were hugely formative to him as a young child, never mind as a filmmaker. Yeah, yeah. Just remind us of who they were, first of all, John.
Well, Powell and Pressburger were a couple of filmmakers. Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. Mm. He was British. Powell was British. Pressburger was Hungarian. And they made throughout the 1940s and into the late 1950s, the pair of them made a series of extraordinary films. Mm. The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, A Matter of Life and Death, Black Narcissus, The Red Shoes. Powell would direct the movies. Pressburger would outline the plot. The two of them together would write the dialogue and the script, essentially, and produce together.
And seemingly, but they never fought about who was doing
not what. A crossword in a 20-odd year collaboration, not a crossword. But they were forgotten then. Powell made a film called Peeping Tom in 1960 before Psycho, which is a very Psycho movie. It was about a serial killer who was using the camera to murder his victims. And it was lambasted, and his career in British cinema was over by 1960. And a lot of the work that they had done up to that point, these beautiful magic films, full of colour, full of movement, inspired by opera and ballet, and they were bringing all of these elements together. And the films were kind of forgotten too. Now they're considered among the most daring and influential British filmmakers of all time. But when Scorsese saw these movies, first on TV, on a black and white TV is where he saw The Red Shoes. Then him and the new Hollywood filmmakers like De Palma, Lucas and Coppola among them,
hugely
they rediscovered them and were hugely influenced by them.
Let's listen to Scorsese talking about how he watched them as, I think he had asthma as a kid, and so
that's
he
right,
had to stay. He said, I was inside a lot more than other kids, and as a result watched a lot of telly where he saw a lot of English and British film.
I used to get excited by the different logos of the different British film companies. But there was one which held out a very special promise. That was The Target of the Archers. That heralded a Powell Pressburger film. And by the time I was 10 or 11, I'd be watching Powell Pressburger films endlessly on TV. They were shown a lot. There was one called The Tales of Hoffman, which is not an obvious film, you'd say, for a child to enjoy. It's basically a 19th century opera, but I just didn't watch it once. I mean, I watched it repeatedly and obsessively. It was on this program called Million Dollar Movie, which showed the same film all week, twice every evening, and three times on the weekend. But the thing was that I was hypnotized by it. And those repeated viewings taught me pretty much everything I know about the relation of camera to music.
There you have Martin Scorsese in the film, a documentary film made in England, the films of Paul and Pressburger, talking about the influence that those films had. And we see him watching, or we see a shot of a, you know, an old black and white television that might have been around in the 50s and 60s. And like, you could, I don't know how he saw the films on them at all, because they're such big visual spectacles, Paul and Pressburger, but he was clearly drawn into them. It's hearing him talk, Scorsese talk, so directly to us about that formative influence. That's what I found fascinating about this, Cara.
I could have sat there and listened to it for another few hours. And I said, the interesting thing was that I started taking notes. It was like listening to some incredible lecture. And I ended up writing about 5 pages of random notes and things that I didn't know and things that I now want to go back and rewatch those films and pick up on. And it was just fascinating to just listen to him. And he didn't M, he didn't he just, it just flows from him perfectly. His understanding of film from such an early age and seeing how it plays in. There's this beautiful point, which I would never have noticed in a million years, about a train and the way the steam comes out. And he picks that up as a child in the film. And this moment really stuck with him. And it's all these tiny things.
Yeah.
And it makes us really understand.
And then he explains how those moments that he saw as a child then made their way into his own,
his own movies. Quite remarkable.
He tells a great anecdote about Mean Streets and Paul saying, it's very red. And well, you did give me the red shoes after all. But
this is the thing about this documentary. It's not directed by Scorsese, directed by a guy called David Hinton, who's won a couple of Emmys.
Usually
put together, but it's just Scorsese talking to camera.
But the
point is, Powell and Pressburger, yes, that's the topic of the documentary. Martin Scorsese's journey through Powell and Pressburger is the point of the documentary. It's really what we're there to hear.
What's important,
fascinating.
One of the important aspects of it is, in terms of Powell particularly, you know, there was a lot of propaganda films during the war, 49th Parallel, and the two guys, what Powell and Pressburger did was, this was nuanced. It wasn't just Allies good, Germans bad.
Yeah. Well, they did make a film really from the German point of view, but they also made A Matter of Life and Death, which Churchill hated because the guy dies.
And you'd wondered to what extent did that affect their career in Britain? Because Scorsese effectively was responsible for rescuing Powell.
He was, absolutely. He would develop a deep friendship with Powell later in his life. Powell, like I said, had become almost unemployable. He was living on his uppers in the UK. Scorsese went over to meet him and brought him back to America and got him a job. He worked for American Zoetrope, which is Coppola's company, as a script reader, and introduced him to his longtime editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, who he would then marry 6 years before he died. In 1990, he married her in 1984, and they had 6 years together. And they were as close friends as Scorsese has had in the film industry. He was as close to them as any of the Spielbergs, De Palma, Lucas, Coppola, any of the people that he came up with, if you like.
Yeah.
He managed to find one of his heroes and rescue him from oblivion. Not only the man himself, but his work as well. And that's a great story. I mean, that's just a great story.
Good story, yeah.
But Scorsese has never steered me wrong, Sean, when he recommends a film or a filmmaker. Except maybe for the 1950s biblical epics, which he's hugely enthusiastic about. I've never cottoned onto them.
All right.
But everything else that Scorsese has recommended.
And if you're going to look at the films of Powell and Pressburger, listen to this.
Oh, this
first,
is a good start.
They will just open up the whole world of their filmmaking to you. Stars on this one, John?
For me, 5 stars. This is as close to perfection as it can get. It's a great theme, it's a great presenter, and it's beautifully assembled. So 5 stars, I couldn't fault it.
Cara?
You know, I've upgraded it from earlier today, and I did mean I'm going with the 5 as well. It really is. It's a beautiful piece of work. And like you say there, I think if anybody is planning on watching their films, this is an amazing way to do it. Watch this first as a fantastic introduction.
It'll open the world up to you for sure. All right, that's a double 5 then for Made in England, the films of Powell and Pressburger, which would be in selected cinemas, including the IFI and the Lighthouse. It'll be there from tomorrow. And before that, we were speaking of Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Goes on general release today. La Chimera is similar to Made in England. It will be selected cinemas, including the IFI and the Lighthouse. My thanks to Cara O'Doherty and John Maguire. May the 16th, this day next week, the RTE Concert Orchestra will be joined by Guy Barker and a number of guests to celebrate the 1950s, the decade that changed the world, in the National Concert Hall. That's what the celebration will be. The cornerstone year of 1959 alone saw the release of multiple legendary albums from the likes of Miles Davis, Charles Mingus, John Coltrane, Dave Brubeck, Ornette Coleman and Horace Silver. And along with these and songs from the films of the era, the show will be celebrating the likes of Judy Garland, Doris Day, Ella Fitzgerald and of course Elvis. It will feature the first Irish performer of Guy Barker's, a performance rather, of Guy Barker's new clarinet concerto, which has the wonderful title of The Art of the Hang, inspired by the 1950s and dedicated to Guy's late friend John Cumming of Sirius Productions. Delighted to be joined this evening by Guy Barker to discuss a little bit more about what this concert is all about. In some ways, you know, we're talking about the decade that changed the world of music, certainly the 1950s, Guy. And if you think of the distance from the type of music we were getting at the beginning of the 1950s, right through to the end of the 1950s when we were getting Miles Davis and Pals that I listed in the introduction, it's a huge journey across those 9-10 years.
It's absolutely massive. And it's I don't know what the reason. I think it happened mostly in the States at the time, because in England there was still rationing and recovering from the war. But in the States, it seemed to be a huge time of optimism, but also experimentation. And people just wanted to try different stuff. You know, we were talking about going to the moon, and you know, we were talking about doing all these great things, and the sense of the avant-garde was turning up. You know, and liberalism, and you know, it was an amazing era, real amazing era, and that's why we wanted to celebrate it.
And let's have a listen to, I mentioned Judy Garland in the introduction, and this, the film version of Get Happy, 1950 itself, the very beginning of the decade. And let's just compare this to what we're going to listen to a little bit later on. This is Judy Garland.
Come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. Get ready for the judgment day. The sun is shining, come on, get happy. The Lord is waiting to take your hand. Shout hallelujah, come on, get happy. We're going to the promised land. We're heading across the river, wash your sins away in the tide. It's all troubles, come on, get happy. You better chase all your cares away.
There we go. That's the voice of Judy Garland from the film Summer Stock and the song Get Happy. Right at the beginning. Go ahead, say again, Guy.
I was going to say there's a really important thing I was just thinking while I was listening to that. If you go back to the swing era and the late 30s and then into the 40s, when you had all the stars of the screen and the stage and every were the band leaders, and you had Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller and Tommy Dorsey and Artie Shaw, and in all those bands the singer was just a sort of small relief moment. They would sit by the stage of the side of the stage and wait their turn, and Sinatra had a position like that in Tommy Dorsey's band. And as the 40s came towards the end, suddenly the singers took over and became the star. And then in the 50s, Sinatra not only becomes that massive star, he also has his own record label. And so there was another kind of revolution
happening there as well. But what struck me particularly in terms of that piece, in some ways you talked about how in England it was, and in Britain it was different, I suppose. They had experienced in their own land the effects of the Second World War. There's a kind of a feeling about the Americans post-World War, and I mean, obviously I'm generalising here, but in that song and that style of musical which we got from MGM at that period, there was a sense of, let's forget about the horrible few years we've just had and get into some kind of fantastical escapist place. In some ways, that's what those musical songs were doing.
They certainly were, and what they were making people do is the States was, you know, the land of, you know, gold and honey, and, you know, people just saw it as this sort of magical place. And, you know, all the cars were big and the houses were big and the roads were big, and it was an exciting thing, you know, for people.
But as the 50s then began to progress, and you do get, we're heading into the 60s, as you say, the big dream of going to the moon starts to come to the fore as the 50s end and the 60s start up. And this kind of individual expression, you know, an expression of the individual as an artist, as a person, started to come to the fore. And New York, I suppose, and the New York jazz scene was very much the centre of what was happening here.
It definitely was. And also, it was the, you know, at the beginning of the 50s, Miles Davis had that album called The Birth of the Cool. And suddenly there was a whole different sound. We hadn't got the more frenetic bebop sound and the big bands, but we had the birth of the cool, and everything had to be cool. And you had people on the West Coast like Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan. And along with that, that kind of film noir, you know, aspect came into it as well. And what's really interesting is that it was affecting Europe. And it was in 1958 when Louis Malle, the great film writer maker, made a film called Lift to the Scaffold. And he flew Miles Davis over from New York and said, just look at the screen and react to it. That had never been done. And Miles just put some basic chords down and created this atmosphere that, you know, will just intoxicate you as soon as you see it. And 1 year later, in 1959, he took that idea and placed it on the album Kind of Blue. And suddenly that album became the kind of album where you might go into somebody's house and they may not have any other jazz records, but they all have Kind of Blue because they know you had to. Yeah, you just had to. And I once did an interview with somebody, a guy. We were talking about Kind of Blue and the jazz that was happening at that time. And I asked him, I said, so are you one of those guys that didn't have, you know, doesn't have any other record, but they have Kind of Blue? And I said, why? And he said, well, the reason is because when I have a dinner party and I have guests around, he said, I put that record on and immediately my home becomes more sophisticated.
Yeah. Well, you know.
But there was something about that, though.
Absolutely. You know. Well, Freddie Freeloader will give us a sense of the kind of sophistication that Miles Davis could do. I mean, he makes this sound so, so easy. But as you know, Guy, more than most, making it sound easy is one of the most difficult things in the world. Let's have a listen. Oh, that's Freddie Freeloader, Miles Davis and band. Guy Barker with me this evening. Is Freddie Freeloader one of the tracks you'll be playing in the concert, or is there other Miles Davis stuff in there, Guy?
Well, I'm doing a medley of all those albums that were made in 1959, and you'll actually hear So What.
All right, yeah.
And then we'll go into a whole load of things. One of the Dave Brubeck tracks, Blue Rondo a la Turk. And Ornette Coleman, Lonely Woman, John Coltrane, Giant Steps, Charles Mingus, Better Get It in Your Soul. I mean,
and this—that's a medley that's a medley that you've put together.
Yeah, I've put a medley of like five or six of the greatest albums that all came out in 1959. I've arranged it all for big band and orchestra.
Yeah. Yeah, and no better group than the RT Concert Orchestra to give you that. I also wanted to talk a little bit about The Art of the Hang, which is a wonderful title for your clarinet concerto. It's its first performance in Ireland, I think, this upcoming as part of the gig.
I really wanted to play it with this orchestra. I played it once in London with a wonderful group called the South Bank Sinfonia, but after working with the RTE so much, I really wanted to play it with them. And the way it came about was the soloist, Giacomo Smith, who has played with the orchestra has become a very good friend of the orchestra and very much admired. He's an absolute brilliant, incredible musician and one of the nicest guys in the world. And I, as soon as I heard him play, I just thought, one day I must write the clarinet concerto for him. And during lockdown, I live alone, and I had all I had for company when we were locked in with the nice weather. The TV was on, and there was a channel called Sony Movies Classics, which kept me company. It was all 50s movies. And there was a documentary on James Dean that was made a year after he died. And I discovered the composer was a guy called Laith Stevens, who I didn't know his work, but he... on the concert, we're also doing a film medley, and I've put in a bit of his work from a very rare film noir called Private Hell 36, which is just the best title. But I remember sitting there thinking, right, okay, I'd finished. I had one piece to write. I had a commission to write something, a piece for a Hong Kong-based musician. And when I finished it, I really sat there and froze and said, now what am I going to do? And I looked up on top of my fridge, and there were two bottles of Sip Smith gin. and I thought, you know what? I could either go there, or I could write that clarinet concerto I've always wanted to write. And the clarinet concerto won.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that you took the lesser of the two evils. Well, actually, it's not two evils at all.
And on the TV, I was intrigued by the music for this James Dean documentary. And at the beginning, there were just two notes. So I thought, okay, right, I'll start with two notes because you've got to find something to get you going, because otherwise you stare at the blank page forever. And I got these two notes down. And at that moment, I got a message saying that John Cumming had just passed away. And John and I were very close, and he was responsible for a massive part of my career. And we were very close, and I was devastated.
Yeah.
And I went out, and I went for a long walk. And then I sat down, and I started writing this piece with tears running down my cheeks. And it was this slow kind of heartfelt piece. And then the title came to me, which was Requiem for a Friend. And then I realized that I was writing the concerto and the slow movement is first. And then I said, right, I'll dedicate it to him. And then I got towards the end and I'm going, yeah, it does what you want it to do. But John used to make you laugh. And so then I went into the various other movements and again, inspired by the 50s. And there's one bit in the third movement that's completely inspired by Brigitte Bardot's film And God Created Woman. And then after he died, I saw an obituary and somebody had written, John had certainly mastered the art of the hang. So I said, I'm having that.
So that was where that title came from. And of course, you mentioned that the slow movement is first, which is what Aaron Copland did with his clarinet concerto, isn't it? And that was first played by Benny Goodman.
True.
So there you go.
That's right.
That kind of jazz feel, it's interesting that you did start out with that slow movement. And obviously that Copland wasn't in your mind, but that is how he does it too.
No, I realise, I know the concerto, but I haven't heard it for ages. I didn't realise that happened. Okay. Thank you.
You'll take that one. And as you say, it's Giacomo who will be playing it then on the concert this night week on the 16th of May. Guy, great to speak with you as always. Will you be doing a little bit of blowing as well as conducting?
Not on this one because there's so much to deal with.
No trumpet this time.
As well as that, there's a film medley and then there's the songs. We've got songs by Louis Prima and Fats Domino and Elvis Presley. So there's a lot to deal with.
Well, listen, I hope it all goes very well, and thanks so much for speaking to us this evening, Guy.
You're very welcome. And is that right, you play the clarinet as well?
No, I don't play the clarinet. Well, I did play a little bit at one point in time, but to say I'm a clarinetist now would be stretching it very, very far indeed.
Somebody told me today, I said, but okay.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. There is a little bit of clarinet playing in there. I was accused of being a trumpet player last night as well, so, God, I'll be a multi-instrumentalist before the week's out.
Exactly.
Guys,
well,
thanks.
Come along to the gig and say hello.
I will do. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. All my secrets are out now. Guy Barker there, who will be conducting the RTE Concert Orchestra, the 1950s, the decade that changed the world. That's at the National Concert Hall on Thursday, the 16th of May. And you can get full details and about tickets and information on rte.ie/CO. There we go. Born in Lagos, in Nigeria, Mufetau Youssef spent his childhood dancing or grooving to the likes of Femi Kuti and traditional Yoruba music. But it wasn't until he moved to Ireland that he was introduced to contemporary dance at the Dublin Youth Academy. At the age of 18, he turned this passion into a profession, starting in productions with Irish Modern Dance Theatre. He has his own debut one-hour long show, Owe, which was part of was shown in the Irish Arts Centre in New York in 2022, and now he's back with another piece, a representation of the black body and sexuality in a show called Impasse. Delighted that Mufetau is with me in studio this evening. I did wonder about the dance that you remember. You moved to Ireland as a 9-year-old, I think we were just saying as we came to air there, Mufetau.
Yeah.
Is there much memory of dance from Nigeria in your mind? Because it's like
social dancing is so big in Nigeria and in West Africa in general. And it's so ingrained in us and in our body. And so memory in the mind, maybe that's I think it's more memory in the body. Like you just have a natural inclination to move in a specific way when you hear music or when you hear a specific kind of music. And then in terms of in the mind, I think, yeah, some steps and some memories and some... Yeah, it's just fond memories of as kids running around.
Yeah.
When we have festivals on the street and then drums comes out and, you know.
And there was a very much a communal aspect.
Absolutely,
to that music, which I guess you must carry into your professional practice.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit then about the setup for Impasse, which I must say sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
It's you and one other performer.
It's me and another performer. He's from Congo and he's based in Brussels in Belgium. And I'm also based in Brussels, so I work between Brussels and Ireland. And so he had a very different experience to me, but it's... at the same time, there's an overlap. And, you know, it's two of us coming from Africa and coming to a Western space and trying to navigate that space. And, yeah, the setup for the whole, like, so it's just basically kind of looking at my own personal experience as a black body, as a black individual, but not just in a conceptual sense, but also in terms of, like, all the layers that might, you know, contain. And then trying to explore that and... looking into racial politics, looking into themes of migration and the diasporic politics and the diaspora and memories and so on, and trying to understand what power and agency does the black body have in a Western space.
And yourself and Lucas are obviously the only two performers who are involved here, and the space itself, it's a totally a white box, is it?
Exactly, yeah. It's a white floor, white marley, and there's a eight by eight, and then there's an 8 meter wide and 2 meter tall wall, and that's our impasse, I guess. That's our dead end, and then we're trying to navigate this space.
I was going to ask you about that, you know, because when we think of an open dance space, I'm thinking, I would guess that a black body moving through a white space without any obstacles would be a little bit unreal, but this wall then presents the impasse.
Exactly, yeah. And I suppose it's more symbolic because it's not to say that my experience in a Western space is forever an impasse, but it's more understanding when we arrive to that place, how do we navigate that, and how do we, you know, do we take a point of detour, or do we go hop over, or maybe we just look inward. So that we're not looking for, that our escape is going inward and understanding what are the layers contained in my body and in Lucas' body, and how do we use that to overcome that impasse. And
you've used, well, the music that you're using has all sorts of influences within it.
Absolutely.
But the piece that I have, the extract that we have from Tom Lehm's composition, very much inspired by Bach.
Yeah.
This section. But are there other influences in there as well?
Definitely, yeah. There are different influences of traditional Yoruba Oriki. And Oriki is basically songs of praises that we use to praise the god, to praise somebody in the community, a king, and so on. And Oriki are also like the praise names, and you know, like very traditional Yoruba names that have history. And so there are elements of that, and then there are strong elements of sound design and using abstract sounds and just different soundscapes. And then, the Bach aspect comes in terms of, for me, classical music and Bach music, Renaissance music, is very much kind of set within a Western context. But I was trying to interrogate what is the Black contribution to that?
Yeah.
You know, like what, or, you know, and just basically taking that and then kind of deconstructing it and then seeing how.
Well, I love, that's what I really liked about this. It kind of pulls the Bach piece apart, and yeah, these other rhythms start to come out, which struck me that they seem to have that Yorubic influence and other influences within it as well. Let's have a listen to a little bit of Tom Lynn's music then that you'll be using as part of this dance show. That's the music of Tom Lynn, or part of the music for Tom Lynn for the show Impasse, which a dancer and choreographer, Mafuta Yosef, is talking to me about in studio this evening. And you do get a sense in that piece, as we were listening to it there, of, yes, the organ is in the background, but that rhythm to the fore seems to bring in
It's from memories of, like, you know, that kind of African rhythm, that kind of... It's also, I always think of, like, a journey, like there's that kind of, there's a pulse that kind of drives us. And I think talking about memory, I think it's really like, it's very vague, but it's very distant, but it's also very much here, and it's coming to the foreground. And that's part of the theme that I...
Yeah, and it does deconstruct that Bach piece in a way that kind of brings out other rhythms within it. This is your third choreographic piece, Mofoto, Pigeon and Owe, previous two pieces. Tell me a little bit about Pigeon, first of all, and what was involved there.
Pigeon was was the first piece I ever did, and it was like the first, I suppose, professional piece after graduating from college. And it's quite short, and I just wanted to explore the place I was in then, which was being Irish, being Nigerian, understanding when that hybrid. And the concept of a pidgin is basically a language that is developed when two cultures merge, and that kind of like the pidginization process that takes place of when you have those two, when you're at the confluence of two different states. And then how did that? So I was using, even there, I was using sound design. I was taking sound from Nigerian market and then sound from Moore Street.
I'm
putting the two sounds together and kind of oscillating between the two and trying to understand how do I navigate that. Like, because market for me are a very strong image of my culture.
And Owe sounds as if it is more something that talks directly.
Owe was looking more into memories and looking into the ancestral archive. So looking into the archive of my ancestors and the archive of the Yoruba people and my own personal archive, and then trying to also merge the aspects of ritual archive, because the ritual that we have in many African communities are archives, and kind of put that with the digital archive that for me is very much, it's I find it a lot here, like museums and so on, and trying to merge the two again.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting how you're bringing those two traditions within your own life together in the various pieces that you've done. And Impasse is Mafoutaou's latest show, Mafoutaou Youssef. It will be premiering at the Project Arts Centre as part of the Dublin Dance Festival, Friday the 24th, Saturday the 25th of May. DublinDanceFestival.ie will give you full details on that. And before we finish up, winner two of tonight's competition, who composed La Traviata? Giuseppe Verdi was the composer there, and Shannon Sweeney from Donegal will be well worth Shannon's trip south, attending the Irish National Opera production of La Traviata at the Gate, and will also have a pre-opera supper at Roberto's restaurant and an overnight stay B&B at the Clarence Hotel. Congratulations to you, Shannon. That is our lot for this Thursday evening. Niall Fitzmaurice, and Barbara Sanwell were our researchers this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RTE Radio 1. And John Creedon will be with you after the news.